helps when I unmute. As Pastor Stephanie said, I am with Faith for Today Television, the oldest religious television broadcast in the world. This coming May, we will celebrate 68 years of television broadcast ministry, and no, I am not the founder. Founded by William and Virginia Fago for the purpose of reaching people who would not go to church if their life depended on it, would not listen to a preacher if their life depended on it. That's what we still do. We do that primarily through interview shows such as Lifestyle Magazine, which is seen by over 3 million people every week in the United States alone. That doesn't count our international numbers. Oh, and by the way, the other thing that makes that so amazing, that we have 3 million viewers, we don't pay for airtime. All the airtime has been donated to us by secular and religious stations and networks alike. They believe in the program, they like the program and its quality. We win secular awards against a broadcast with 5 times the budget. And so I'm proud of the product that we put out. And networks recognize it. And so they're happy to air it. And they know it holds good numbers for them. And we get good celebrities on as well, which helps them as well. We focus on the areas of personal relationship, personal finance, and personal health. The three areas that unchurched people tell us that if the church could help them with, they might visit a church. Go figure. So that's what we do. And then we try to connect those viewers with local congregations. So that's the ministry of Faith for Today, and I covet your prayers in that. You know, the thing that I think the world needs, and I see this in the television programming, I see it in my contact, my interaction with secular people, people in Hollywood, Nashville, professionals, physicians, scholars, academics. I see one thing. I see that people need a more proper, a more accurate picture of who God is. We've misunderstood Him. We've misrepresented Him. The world distorts Him. We've been guilty of the same thing ourselves as a church at times. When Jesus is seen as He truly is, He says He is irresistible. He says that if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to Me. When you see Him as He is, He's irresistible. And He also said, if you've seen Me, you've seen the Father. So seeing the Son tells us who the Father is, and it's a picture that is absolutely irresistible. That's who God is. Someone said the truth about God is He's infinitely better than we've ever dared dream possible. Do you believe that's true? Is He infinitely better than you've ever dared dream possible? Or is He a cosmic killjoy waiting for you to step out of line? As a kid, I was wondering why God was all that interested in the length of my hair when He had so much world at war and poverty and disease and abuse. Seriously? That you're really that concerned about my hair? Well, the truth is He wasn't. That really didn't bother Him. What bothered Him is when I exhibited the same qualities that cause war and hunger and abuse and hatred. When I was selfish, that bothered Him. And He longed for me to have a better life and to understand there's a better way to live. He longed for me to see Him as He truly is. I believe that that's the most compelling issue in theology today. I think it's the most compelling issue for our witness today, to reveal the heart of the Father. And by the way, when you as an earthly father see the heart of the heavenly Father, it changes you. It makes you more like Him. You as an earthly mother see the heart of God, it changes you. It changes your marriage. It changes your parenting. It changes every relationship in your life. You cannot see Him as He is and remain unchanged. He is that powerful. He is that good. He is that glorious. There's a story in Scripture I'd like to draw your attention to, and it has been labeled as the story of the prodigal son. I think that that's misnamed. It's not a story about the son. This is not a story about the son. This is a story about the father. It's a story about the heart of the father. And I'm going to take a different look at this than maybe you've heard before. It doesn't mean that other looks are wrong. The beauty of the parables is that you can look at them from so many different aspects, so many different angles, and find wonderful truth in each one of them. You can find things you never saw before, things you never understood, and just a brand new way of looking at it. I hope that this will do that for you to some degree. Now, before we start on this, let's back up just a little bit and realize that Jesus was being criticized for hanging out with bad people, which, frankly, I'm rather happy for, because if he hangs out with bad people, it gives me some hope, right? The thing I know about myself, the closer I get to Jesus, the worse I look. And when I see myself in the mirror and he says that he loves me, I can't quite figure that out. I don't get it, because I see myself as, and it's not too good. But Jesus hung out with bad people, and it gives me hope. And so when he was criticized for that, he told three parables: the parable of the lost coin, the lost sheep, and the lost son, you could say. But all three of those are actually parables about God. Because in the lost coin, the father is the woman who searched the house until he found that which was lost. In the lost sheep, God is the shepherd who leaves the 99 in the fold as he goes looking for the one which was lost. That's how much he cares about the one that was lost. And in this story, the story that is commonly referred to as the prodigal son, it is the heart of the father that matters in this story. Now, as a little cultural background, back in those days, if you were a farmer, if you owned land, chances were you didn't actually live on your land. Very few people, especially in the places away from the city, lived on their land. They actually formed small communities, villages, of about 5 or 6 acres, and usually there are about 200 or 300 people that would live in these. Sometimes they would be walled and sometimes not. They gathered together and lived in those confined spaces for safety and for community. Without much law in the land, if marauding bandits came by, you were defenseless against them unless you were with a larger group of people. And so they gathered together. You had a house here in this little community, in this little village or city, and then you would go out to work your land. And the land was special to them. It still is today in Israel. You know that musical Oklahoma? There's a song that says, "We know we belong to the land." I won't sing much of it, I promise. "And the land we belong to is grand," right? That was Israel only on steroids. Because the land, they belonged to the land, and the land was their promise from God. It was their soul. And if you owned land, you never, ever, ever sold it. And if you got down to the point where you absolutely had, you were in dire straits if you had to sell your land, because you weren't just selling a piece of real estate. You were selling your soul, your identity, your connection to Israel. You were selling who you were. And so no one sold the land unless it was just a dire emergency. You didn't want to do that, because you belonged to the land. It didn't belong to you. You belong to God and to Israel, and you were a part of his promise. So you didn't sell it. So instead, they would work their land. They live in these little villages. And in these villages, there were basically three classes of people that lived in these. First of all, there was the landowner and his family. That was one group of people. Then there were skilled craftsmen. These were people who were paid well. They had learned a craft that was necessary for landowners and for herdsmen and the like, and they were paid well for their service there. And then there was a third category, and these were slaves. Slaves, there was a very different kind of a thing in Israel than we think of it in American history. It was not limited to one group of people, one race. You could enter into slavery voluntarily if you had a great debt. Basically, the only thing that you would go into slavery for was to pay off a debt, usually. And then there was a term of service, after which your slavery, your service as an indentured servant or a slave was over, and that usually would not last any longer than 7 years. There were special circumstances whereby you could remain in slavery longer, but it was usually of short duration. It was still an onerous thing. It was the bottom of society. It was the lowest rung on the totem pole, so to speak, and you didn't want to be there. But those were the three groups of people. Basically, these were people who owed the landowner a debt too great to repay, and so they entered into service in order to pay off that debt. Those were the three groups of people who lived there. Now, this is important to remember as we begin to unpack this particular story. So let's take a look here, if you would please, at Luke's Gospel, the 15th chapter. We're going to begin with verse 11. And he said, "A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me.' So he divided his wealth between them." Now, that seems like a fairly benign start to a story, but if you lived in that culture, this spoke volumes to you, and you were already gasping for breath. First of all, if you had two sons, that was a good thing. When the father would die and there were two sons, the inheritance would be split up at that point into three sections, the older son taking two sections along with the birthright, and the younger son usually taking one section. So this is a younger son saying, I want my third and I want it now. But to do that meant he was going to the father and saying, I hate your guts. I don't want to identify with you. I wish you were dead. Please give me what I have coming to me now. Now, for a son to do that in that culture was just unheard of. Such a son could possibly be stoned, but certainly the community, that little village of 200 to 300 people, would enact a ceremony which would declare to him, not only are you not a part of your father's family anymore, you're not a part of our village. We renounce you, we denounce you from the house of Israel. You are nothing to us. We will not render aid to you. We will not help you in any way. You are outside of God's grace. You are outside of Israel because of your treatment of your father. That was very common, and such a thing would take place. And it was, I think that part of the motivation of the father in this story is to avoid that ceremony for his son. The shame and the humiliation. The son shamed the father. Shame avoidance is one of the strongest emotions and strongest motivators for behavior in the East. You do anything to save face. And when a son says, I wish you were dead, that's about the biggest shame you can get. So this father should have reacted in anger, should have turned him over to the villagers and let them have their way with him. He would be done. He would be gone. But the father does something entirely different. No one expected this. He gave the son what he asked for. Now, in those days when a father was alive and he gave, it was possible to give your inheritance, your possessions to your sons, even while you were still alive. And it meant that although it was theirs and they could use it, as the father, you still could take anything you wanted because it was still yours in practice. If you wanted the fatted calf, you could have it. If you wanted the fruit of the land, you could have it. You can consume what you want, but you recognize that it's already in your son's name. Your son would own it, but they could not sell it. As long as the father alive, well, they could enter into a negotiation to sell, but the purchaser could not accept, could not take possession of the land until the father died. There was no provision for him to accept possession of the land until the death of the father occurred. So the son has possession, he can negotiate it, but you can agree to buy it, but you can't take possession of it. So it would mean that there's not much in the way of negotiation that's going to go on, and you're certainly not going to pay much for that because you don't know when you would get it. But the younger son asked for this land, and then he asked for something says something very strange about it. Verse 13, and not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. He sold the property. The only way for him to do that is for the father to agree that the purchaser would take immediate possession. Unheard of. So much so that there was absolutely no provision in law to govern this because no one ever dared dream it would happen. It was beyond the pale of consideration. Certainly this would never happen. But the father loved the son so much that not only did he give him his inheritance early, but when he said, I want to sell it, he gave permission for the land to transfer from his name to the purchaser's name. This was unheard of because, first of all, the father's selling his soul. His soul is ripped out from him because of the insult paid by his own son. An insult that is in full view of the village. The village was so small that everybody knew everybody else's business. If you had an argument with your wife in the morning, by afternoon, everybody knew about it and they had chosen sides. So everybody knew this. This is a drama that was playing out in front of this village. Everybody in the village saw. They saw the shame that the father endured with the son. He took that shame and he turned it into grace. He took the pain and turned it to grace. Yes, son, you want your inheritance here. I want to sell it. I need the money so I can leave. I'll give permission for the land to transfer so that the new owner can take possession immediately. Negotiations for land in Israel could take months, even years. This happened just a few days. The father facilitated this. The father made it happen. Unthinkable, unspeakable, but he cared more about the son than he did his own soul, his own land. And the son took the land, took the money, went to a foreign country, and squandered it with loose living. By the way, loose living, the original language does not imply anything immoral. It implies frivolous living. The older brother accused him of immoral living, but this particular word does not imply that. So we don't know for sure that he was immoral. We do know he was frivolous, that he spent money like water, and he went through it rather quickly. Now when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. In our generation, in our country, it's almost impossible to understand the impact of a famine in that day. In that day, when a famine occurred, that meant that there was no food. There was no water, no rain, you can't grow anything, and it doesn't matter how much money you have. If there's no food, you starve. So families and clans would gather together. They would pool their meager resources. And then someone over here can grow a little something over here. I've got some water. I can grow a little something. I'll share it with the whole. I'm a hunter. I found some game. I've got sheep. You realize they're pooling their resources to survive. If you didn't have a family, you died in a famine. Period. End of story. If you had no way of producing food, you died. And this son was going to die because he had ostracized himself from his family. If the ceremony had not been enacted, if he went home, it certainly would be. And no one would give him aid. No one would help him. Without a family, without a clan, without a village, you died in a famine. He's very much at risk. So he's very much in want. Verse 15, so he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. You see, in those days when something like this would happen, such a poor individual as this boy would find someone who had something, who had some wealth, had some food, and they would stick to them like bad gum on your shoe. You couldn't get rid of them. And it was a shameful thing to do. It was an embarrassing thing to do. But you know what? You got to survive. And so you couldn't shake them. This guy couldn't shake this kid. He was longing for some food, and so he thought, well, I'll give him a job that he won't do. He's a Jew. I want to send him out to feed my pigs. The kid took the job. Who knew? He'd do anything to survive. But the job didn't pay too well, as we see here later. Verse 16, and he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving anything to him. So there wasn't much money, not much food for him. He was, when a Jewish boy finds himself envious of pigs, then you know he's hit rock bottom. He wanted to eat what the pigs were eating, but they were eating pods. These were more than likely carob pods, and although cattle and pigs can consume them, they are too coarse to be consumed by humans. They would just rip up his intestines. So he knew he couldn't eat them. They would kill him. But he wished he could eat what the pigs were eating. As bland and tasteless and difficult as it was, that's where he had gone in his life. And he knew he was in danger of dying because no one was giving him anything. He's a foreigner. He was frivolous. He went through his money. He doesn't belong to anyone. There is no association for him. We're not going to help him. We're just trying to survive ourselves. But when he came to his senses, verse 17, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I'm dying here of hunger? Notice he didn't say, I know my father's slaves are eating well. They're serving him. They're working hard without pay, but they're eating well. He didn't say that. He said, I know the skilled craftsmen, those who are hired by my father, are making enough money to feed themselves, their children, and they have money left over. They're eating. He didn't envy a slave. He envied an artisan. This is an important point, I think, as we move forward. He wasn't saying, Lord, just, you know, Father, just, I just want to be a slave. No, he wanted to be paid for his services. And I think there's a very good reason for that as we move on. He said, I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. By the way, that in itself is not an apology that anyone in the East would accept. Because he's not being specific. To be accepted, to even have a chance of being accepted, he would have to say, Father, I shamed you by wishing you dead and telling you so in front of everyone. I shamed you by asking that I take my share of the inheritance. I shamed you and the family and the village by selling it while you were yet alive. I shamed you by taking those resources into a Gentile nation and just wasting them there. I shamed you by rejecting you. That would be an apology. That's starting with an apology that would be accepted in the East. But to say, yeah, I did some bad things, is not an apology. And no right-thinking Easterner would ever accept it. No right-thinking Jew would accept that. They would. They say, you're not sorry. This is ridiculous. This is not an apology. He's not actually thinking about just being forgiven, I don't believe. Instead, he says, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. By the way, in the Greek, that really probably ought to be translated, I am not currently, I'm not now worthy. In other words, the thought is, at some point I could be worthy. The only way to be worthy is to undo what you have done, to buy back the land. How's he going to do that? He has no money. He said, make me as one of your hired sons. In other words, he's saying, find an apprenticeship for me. I'm not married. If your hired hands, those skilled craftsmen make enough money to feed their family, wife and children, and still have money left over, me as a single man, I can save a lot of money. I'm going to earn my way back into your good graces. If you'll find an apprenticeship for me, it'd have to be out of that village because no one in the village would take him, but maybe he has connections someplace else. Send me there, let me be an apprentice. I'll learn, I'll come back, work for you, and I'll buy the land back. I think that's what he's doing. He's not offered a real apology. He said, I want to be a hired hand. He has no skills. How can you be a hired hand? The only way to do that is to have an apprenticeship, because I'm not currently worthy to be called your son, but if you give me a chance, I'll earn it back. He wants to earn his way back to the Father. Man, have I seen that before? Have I seen that before? People think, if I can just do this, maybe I can earn my way back into the good graces of God. I can earn my way back. And we get some pretty clouded thinking over that. Some very clouded thinking over that. And that's why you see sometimes people who come back from a life of sin, come back to the church, go the extreme opposite. Extremely legalistic and radical in their approach to religion. Both are wrong. Both are unhealthy. He's going to try to work his way back. I will get up and go to my father, verse 18, and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I am not currently or no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. So he got up and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. The father watched the horizon every day because he knew that boy. He knew that the saying, a fool and his money are soon parted, would be true for that boy. And the boy was going to be hungry. And he kept watching for him because he wanted to be the first one to get to him. If the villagers got to him, it could be bad. He wanted to get to him first and forgive him. And so every day the father watched, and one day he finally saw a figure and it looked like his son. And the father ran. Now, men did not run in those days, especially not wealthy men. They always had one foot on the ground and they never exposed their legs. They wore robes. The only way to run in a robe is to reach through the bottom of the robe, get the back part of it, pull it up, and tuck it into your belt, thus making shorts, freeing the legs to run. No rich man ever did that, but that's what the man did. The servants were out there, you know, slaves were there with him, and all of a sudden he stands up, makes shorts, and starts running. What is, has he lost his mind? And then they see the boy in the distance, and they think he's going to kill him. The boy's got to be wondering that too. Notice what the father does before the boy says a word. He falls on his neck and kisses him, giving him the symbol of forgiveness. The father forgave the boy before he even knew if the boy was going to apologize. The father forgave the boy before he said a word. He didn't wait for the apology. In that culture, what would have typically happened is the mother would have run to the boy. The father would have stayed in the house and said, I'm not going to that boy. The mother then would have gone in and pled on behalf of the boy. Please, he's so pathetic. He's so pitiful. He's so sorry. Please listen. And then maybe the father would let the boy come in, and the boy would crawl on his hands and feet and would kiss the father's feet, begging him for forgiveness. That didn't happen. That's what should have happened. That's what everyone expected. But the father ran to the boy, something the boy had never seen his father do in his life. He'd never seen him run. He ran to the boy, he fell on his neck, and he gave him the symbol of forgiveness before the boy said a word. The father didn't know if the boy was just passing through. He didn't know if he was coming back to say. He didn't know if he was coming back to apologize. He didn't know if he was coming back to lord it over him. He said, "I love you and I accept you now." And the boy had said not a word. "You are mine. I love you. And I forgive you." Even before the boy got into a speech. And the son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. I'm not currently worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his slaves, he just ignored him. Yada, yada, yada. I don't care. But the father said to the slaves, "Quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him. They won't respect him, but my village, they'll respect me when they see my party robe on the boy. They'll respect me, and they won't hurt him. When they see my robe on him," Christ covers you with a robe, doesn't he? And put a ring on his hand. He's sold the family signet. Now he knows that he's a part of the family. I'm putting a ring on his finger because he's mine. He's not a hired hand. He's not a slave. He's my son. Put sandals on his feet. Slaves go barefoot. Sons wear sandals. Put shoes on my boy's feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead. Why was he dead? He chose to be dead. "I'm dead to you," he said. He was dead and yet has come to life again. Why is he alive? Because the Father made him alive. He was lost. Why was he lost? He chose to be lost. And has been found. Why was he found? The Father found him. And they began to celebrate. The older son was in the field, came and approached the house, heard music and dancing, and he summoned one of the servants, began to inquire what these things could be. He said, "Your brother was come. Your father's killed the fatted calf," because he received him back safe and sound. The older son refused to go in. You see, when there was a rift between the father and the son, it was the older son's position. He should have been the mediator to mediate between the father, but he was silent, which means he had a broken relationship with the father as well. He served him out of duty and drudgery, although he loved not his father. The younger boy rebelled. Both were in rebellion, just different ways. One was aggressive, the other passive-aggressive. Same thing. Both were, and yet the father, when the boy refused to come into the party for his younger son, that was an insult to his father. He said, "You've not given me a fatted calf." "What do you mean, given you? It's yours. You didn't let me celebrate with my friends. Aren't your friends in here? The whole village is here. A fatted calf would feed about 200 people the way they did it. Everybody's here. Who are your friends? Are they not mine?" He's rejecting everything his father stands for and everybody his father knows. He hates him too. He's estranged from him. And the father should have rejected him. He should have punished him. But instead he said, "All that I have is yours." And he loved the older son as well. Both sons were redeemed by the heart of the Father. A heart so full of love. He didn't wait for either one of them to apologize. He just said, "I love you." You know, some people have said that this actually, Jesus through this parable has given us a due definition of repentance. Repentance is the acceptance of having been found. When you look at this story, kind of hard to argue. Ultimately, there needs to be a sorrow for our sin, but that only comes because God loves us. Ultimately, by His grace, we turn and we change, but that's only because it's not about you. It's about Him. It's always been about Him. Every time you try to make it about you, you're wrong. It's not about you. It's never been about you, about how good or how bad you are. Even what you believe, it's about Him. And how good He is and how He changes people. He redeems to the uttermost. And He redeems you. The Father's heart is bigger than you've ever dared dream possible. Bigger. I was preaching for a camp meeting in Kansas, Nebraska. They were saving money. They had a very short camp meeting, a Friday night, Sabbath all day, and a Sunday morning. I was the only speaker. They were saving money. They flew me in, put me in a girl's dorm. They were saving money. No hotel. I'm lucky I didn't have to walk there, you know. But I preached Friday night, twice Sabbath morning, one Sabbath afternoon, one Saturday night, and one Sunday morning. They were getting their money's worth, brother. And not much money at that. So I got there, and I got settled in the girls' dorm, and I had a guest room there, and I was walking across. If you've ever been to Union College, where they hold this camp meeting, you got this big stone gate there between the campus and the College View Church there, big wraparound church. And I was walking over to the Friday night meeting when I saw a guy about my age standing underneath that stone arch looking at it, hands in his pockets. I said, "You about got it figured out?" "Yeah, I think I could do that." "You in construction?" "Yeah." "What's your name?" "Larry." "Larry, where are you from?" "Kansas." "Larry, you happy to be at camp meeting?" "No." "Why are you here?" "I started going to this church. They thought I needed it, so they brought me here." "Hmm. Going to the meeting tonight?" "Don't know." "Larry, I think you ought to go." "Why?" "I'm preaching." "Who are you?" "My name's Mike." "What you preaching about?" "Jesus." "I don't know." "Larry, when I start preaching, I'm going to be looking for you, buddy. I want you there." And I left. Went through the preliminaries, and finally I get up and I'm preaching this big wraparound church. And I'm looking all over for Larry, and I'm not seeing him. Finally, I spot him at the furthest corner of the church, standing with his back against the wall, right next to the door, just in case. Arms folded like this, just glaring at me. I preached the gospel that night as hard as I know how to preach it. I preached the heart of the Father. I preached of His grace. After the meeting, I was standing down here shaking hands. I looked up and there was Larry. Larry got in there and the roof hadn't fallen in on him. Came all the way down. I was proud of him. He looked at me and said, "The things you said tonight, true?" "No, Larry, just made them up." I said, "Not only are they true, but God's better than I told you He was, because I don't have the words to give you to tell you how good God is. I'm not that smart." Said, "Well, that's certainly not what they taught when I grew up in this church." I said, "Oh, you grew up in the church." Then the story came out. Larry was born to an unwed mother who was a drug and alcohol addict. And so severe were her addictions that the state took Larry away from her and put him in an orphanage where he began to grow up. What the state didn't know is that Larry was deaf. And they thought he was either retarded or nuts because they couldn't control him. In fact, it got so bad when he was 6 years old, they put him in the psych facility adjacent to the orphanage in a padded room. Iron door with a little glass with the chicken wire in it, you know. About that time, an older couple from Kansas came and they said, "We want to adopt your most difficult case." They said, "Well, that'd be Larry, but you don't want him." "Why not?" "Well, he's either retarded or insane. We don't know which. We want to see him." They went to the psych facility, looked through the glass window, looked at each other, and said, "We'll take him." They said, "We don't know who's crazier, you or Larry." But they adopted him, took him home to Kansas. These were Seventh-day Adventists. They took him to an Adventist physician who was a friend of theirs. He examined Larry and found out that he was deaf. They fitted him with hearing aids, and Larry was not insane, wasn't retarded. He could learn fine. He was ADD, which half the people in this room are. I see you looking at your watch. When is it going to be done? I mean, look at the clock, really. Seriously? Where's my phone? I don't know. I know you. I see you. Takes one to recognize one, but still. He was ADD before they knew what ADD really was, and he was behind everybody, but he could learn. He struggled in school, but he was progressing. Mom and Dad were Adventists, but they were legalists, and that's all they knew. These were good people, but in legalism, there's no hope. You're never good enough. So Larry knew he never measured up. Went to school, didn't measure up. Church didn't measure up. And when he turned 17, 18, he got out of there as soon as he could. During the Vietnam War, He joined the army. They were, if you could chew gum and walk at that time, they'd take you, because they wanted to send people to Vietnam. He went into the army and loved it, because in the army, if you did what you were expected to do, it was good. Here's the list. You can do that. Do that, and you're good. He advanced to the rank of sergeant, did a couple of tours in Vietnam, stayed in for a career, married, had two kids. She ran off on him, left him with the two kids, and he realized to raise them, he had to leave the army. Took him back to Kansas, started a construction business. The kids grew up and left, and Larry thought, now what? So he started going back to the same church he'd been at as a kid. He said, some things have changed and some things are the same. But if they'd been preaching this, I never would have left the church. Next morning, Larry was there for the first service. I preached the gospel as hard as I know how to preach it. And Larry was no longer standing at the back. He was seated on the back row. Progress has been made. Second service that morning, he was a third of the way down. That afternoon, he was two-thirds of the way down. Saturday night, he was front and center. Sunday morning, I preached the last time. And I had to run, catch a flight. I had another appointment. Larry grabbed me. He said, I want to be baptized. I said, praise God, Larry. I'll tell your pastor. I'll tell, who can I talk to? I'll get this going. He said, no, you don't understand. You're going to do it. How am I going to do that, Larry? I got a flight to catch. I don't think they got a baptistry full. He said, where are you going to be next week? I'll be preaching in Texas, 500 miles away from me. This is August. He said, I'll be there. I said, just a second. I called the pastor. I said, would you fill the baptistry for me? Have a certificate ready? He said, yeah, I'll do it. He said, Larry, the doctrines. He said, I grew up in this church. If I don't know them by now, you think there's any hope for me? I asked him a few qualifying questions and figured, okay, I'll meet you in Texas. Next week, Larry had driven 500 miles in an unair-conditioned truck to get to the church in Texas. And I stood in the baptistry with Larry. Because Larry finally saw the Father. And when he saw the Father, it changed everything. The prodigal had come home. He'd sold everything. He'd wasted it all. But now he saw the Father loved him and accepted him even before he asked. When I lowered him into the watery grave, he came up and I saw the glory of God in his face, because for the first time in his life, he had been accepted. Rejected, he thought, by his mother, by the state, by the church, by the school, by his adopted parents, by his wife. But Jesus took him as he was. And today, my friend, Jesus takes you as you are. The heart of your Father is far better than you ever dared dream possible. He adores you. Accept his embrace.